Show here on the Big 550 KTRS. Thank you very much for listening. You can follow me on Twitter at Paul Harris Show. You can email me, paul@harrisonline.com, especially if you've got a knucklehead in the news story that I can use and give you credit for on the air. We do that at 5:30 every Friday afternoon, right after the Harris Challenge. But now in the 4 o'clock hour, it's time for the showbiz stuff that Max and I do every week, starting off with reviews of new movies that are opening up, and there are a couple of them opening in town that are both dripping with testosterone this weekend. One of them is called 12 Strong, which stars Chris Hemsworth, who is what superhero?
Thor.
Okay. You saw this one, so take it.
All right, 12 Strong is the latest in the January military movies mini franchise. It seems almost every January we get movies like The Kingdom or Hurt Locker or Zero Dark Thirty.
I think Hacksaw Ridge came out.
Hacksaw Ridge, you're right. 13 Hours, The Secret Soldiers of Benghazi.
American Sniper.
American Sniper, Lone Survivor. And these movies always do really well in January. In January, there's not a lot of new releases. There's smaller pictures, maybe some scary films, and a lot of leftovers from the previous year.
Things that were released in New York and Los Angeles for awards consideration, we get them in January.
Absolutely. A lot of the country does. And so to have movies like this, which have a built-in audience, they usually do pretty well at the box office. And I think 12 Strong will as well. This is a true story. It's based on a book called Horse Soldiers, which is a great name for this movie. But that was also the name of a John Wayne movie a long time ago. So they decided to call it 12 Strong.
It's about a bunch of guys in the military who have sore throats.
No, close, very close. I would have called the movie 12 Horsepower, but I guess that's not very fast, so maybe that's why they didn't do that.
That actually sounds like a Fast and Furious movie.
Right, that's kind of a cool title, right? But they went with 12 Strong.
So 12 Horsepower is not a lot of power.
Exactly, yeah. Right, yeah, but I still think it's clever. So this is the true story that we hadn't really heard before now, and it's been declassified, and that's why we're getting this movie. The very first American boots on the ground in Afghanistan post 9/11 was a special elite special forces team named Team Dagger that ended up for the first time since World War I being armed soldiers on horseback.
Why were they on horseback?
Well, they didn't have a whole lot of other options, Paul. You see, right after 9/11, our military was immediately getting intel that it was bin Laden, it was the Taliban, they targeted Afghanistan. Of course, this was a major initiative, and we had to figure out what is the best course of action.
Because that's where the Al-Qaeda bases were.
Absolutely.
From where the 9/11 plan was was carried out.
And of course, we'd kept tabs on the Taliban and bin Laden for almost 30 years previous. We knew that the Russians had just turned tail in Afghanistan because they got beaten by these forces. So we were sort of testing out the waters here. We only sent in 12 soldiers. That's kind of what we do. We're going to send a strike force, figure some things out, then we're going to throw in all of the big guns. So Chris Hemsworth plays a character who was on leave with his family, and then 9/11 happened. He did what a lot of people did if they were in the military. They went right back to work. And for him, that was saying, send me over there. And so he does that. He takes his special forces team, who are, of course, 12 men, among them Trevante Rhodes, who was the oldest version of the kid in Moonlight. You know, there's three different eras of that kid's life.
Oh, yeah.
And he was the eldest. He's in this movie. Also, Michael Shannon playing a rare good guy. I don't know if I've ever seen him play a good guy before.
Well, he was pretty good in Elvis and Nixon, not as a villain, but in a lot of other movies, he does play the villain. You're right.
He usually plays the villain. Here, he's still gruff, but he's a good guy.
I'll never forget him as Iceman, the mafia killer.
Oh, that's right. That's right. The Iceman. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that's a great movie. Yeah. You also have Michael Pena, who's always fun to see on screen. And as we pointed out, Chris Hemsworth. Now, Chris Hemsworth, he's fine as Thor. Of course, he looks the part. He looks like a deity. You know, he's a giant mountain of a man.
When I see him, I think I'm looking in a mirror.
Of course. I mean, it's tough to do the show with you, Paul, because you look just like Chris Hemsworth.
Right.
But anytime he tries to play...
What would Chris Hemsworth look like if he just ate pizza and chocolate? That's what you get.
Paul Harris.
Yeah.
No,
it's a mirror in a funhouse. Did I forget to mention that?
It's strange to see him try to play these everyman roles. He was in The Heart of the Sea for Ron Howard. He was in Black Hat for Michael Mann. Look, I'm just a fisherman. Look, I'm just a computer hacker. Look, I'm just an American soldier. No, you're Chris Hemsworth.
Yeah.
And at the end of the movie, they show you a photograph photograph of the actual people, and the guy that he's playing looks a little bit like Sam Elliott back in the day. He's got the handlebar mustache, almost like a cowboy, which 20 years ago would have been great casting to just put Sam Elliott here. But he's fine. I actually like Hemsworth more doing comedies like Vacation or Ghostbusters. I think he's very funny. But anyway, they go over to Afghanistan, and when they get there, their superiors tell them, look, we're trying to go after the Taliban, and there are other anti-Taliban forces here that we want you to go and meet and become pals with, so you can they can tell you where to go, and then we'll drop some aerial bombs. Well, the only bad thing is here, the anti-Taliban forces don't like one another either. And so if I make friends with you and we go to fight our common enemy, but then another anti-Taliban force comes, they're also going to fight us. So the odds are against you no matter where you turn.
So that old saying, the enemy of my enemy is my friend.
That's exactly what it was.
Does not work, because in this case, it's the enemy of my enemy, and that's going to cause problems for me and my friends.
It's the enemy of my enemy is my friend for now. And so it's always a very tense situation. When they are moving into their target, they realize they can't just drive into town because everybody will see them. So one of their contacts says, okay, here are your horses. And this was the first time that American soldiers were on horseback with modern weapons since World War I. And so that's why it's called 12 Strong, and that's why the book was called Horse Soldiers. So it's a really interesting story that I wasn't aware of.
Okay.
And it was the first strikes that we made after 9/11 to the Taliban and to bin Laden. It's a nice book into a movie like Zero Dark Thirty, which of course shows the end of that whole saga. Now, those are all the positives. It's an interesting story that I wasn't aware of. The negatives are some of the dialogue is clunky and some of it is downright cheesy. I understand a movie like this is going to, by its nature, be patriotic, and it should be. However, some of the rah-rah, sis-boom-bah dialogue is a little cheesy. Also, it doesn't have a lot of visual flair. We're talking about being set in the mountains of Afghanistan, and that's pretty much all you get. So when they have a dust-up, there's a lot of dust on the screen, and then the next firefight is more dust on the screen.
So the movie's all brown and gray?
It feels gray, and it feels like I just saw this. It sort of becomes a bit repetitious.
Mm.
Now, that being said, it has somewhat of a surprising ending because of the odds against these 12 men. And when it was over, it got applause from the whole audience. I think this will do very well at the box office. I think that it's nice to see an inspiring post 9/11 movie. And I think it'll do pretty well.
What do you give it on a scale of 10?
I will give Horse Soldiers, aka 12 Strong, I'll give this an 8.
Okay.
Yeah.
The other movie that's opening up this weekend, another action movie dripping with testosterone, is called Den of Thieves. It is a heist movie at its core. And I've talked before about how I like heist movies. And the more complicated the crime, the better. And the heist that's at the center of Den of Thieves certainly qualifies as a complicated, clever heist.
Okay.
Unfortunately, it gets bogged down in too much plot nonsense. Let me tell you a little bit about the movie. And again, I'm not going to give away spoilers. I'm just going to give you the basics here. The hero is Nick Flanagan, who's played by the awful actor Gerard Butler.
He's a horrible actor.
He was in Olympus Has Fallen. He was in London Has Fallen. He was in some movie with Katherine Heigl years ago.
I think it was The Awful Truth, and that is unwatchable.
Yes, it
is. I know, because I tried to watch it.
Me too. It was awful, and that's the truth. That's my entire review of that movie. Well, in this one, he actually does an okay job as Nick Flanagan.
Bite your tongue, Paul Harris.
I didn't say he was good. I said he does an okay job as the head of the Los Angeles Sheriff's Department Major Crime Squad. Calling him the hero doesn't mean that the character is all good, because Nick and his fellow elite cops are not above kidnapping and torturing to get the information that they need. Pablo Schreiber, who you've never heard of and neither have I, plays the villain in this movie, simply known as Merriman. He's an ex-Marine and an ex-con who's put together his own elite team, which includes Curtis 50 Cent Jackson and a driver played by O'Shea Jackson Jr. That is Ice Cube's son, who played Ice Cube in Straight Outta Compton last year.
Mm-hmm.
He's the best thing in this movie.
He was great in Straight Outta Compton, too.
You will not recognize anybody else in the cast, but if you look closely, you might spot a very small part for Eric Braeden, who's been on the soap opera The Young and the Restless for 38 years. The only thing I've ever seen him in, because I don't watch soap operas, is one of my guilty pleasures, is a 1970 sci-fi thriller called Colossus, The Forbin Project. Have you ever seen that, Max?
I have not. It's a great title. I've not heard of it.
It's about some scientists who develop computers. Think of it as Skynet before Skynet in the Terminator movies.
Okay, yeah.
Without all the Arnold Schwarzenegger kind of action. It's very clever, and I'm sure if I watched it now, I think it was cheesy. But when I was younger, I thought the movie was terrific. So he has a very small part. You'll barely notice him. But I mention it because I did. Now, I'm not going to give away any of the details of the heist in Den of Thieves, except to say that it involves the L.A. branch of the Federal Reserve, which the movie says is the only bank in that city that's never been robbed. The intricacies of the plan are fascinating. They are captured on screen very well by the first-time director, Christian Gudegast, who also wrote this movie, who also wrote London Has Fallen with Gerard Butler.
There we go. That's how we got Gerard. That's, I was like, how does a first-time director screenwriter get Gerard Butler?
Well, I don't know if Gerard Butler got him the role.
Oh, you know, right.
Somebody gave him, it's possible.
I see what you're saying.
Well, actually, the movie was written by this guy, Christian Gudegast, who probably went to his buddy Gerard Butler and says, hey, let's make this movie together. Well, yeah. And Butler said, okay. And Christian said, can I direct it? And Gerard said, well, I'll throw around my massive box office heavyweight status.
I mean,
which doesn't exist.
Have you seen Geostorm? I mean, come on. The guy's a legend.
Apparently, enough to get Christian Gudegast the chance to do this. And he gets the cap, the action very well. And I like it when movies like this, heist movies especially, or con artist movies, I like it when they keep part of the plan secret from us and then catch us by surprise with something we didn't know until the very end. For instance, Ocean's 11 is one of those kind of movies. All of the great ones have some sort of twist.
I love heist movies. It's a wonderful genre. And you're right. I like it when the movie is a little smarter than the audience. But besides the intricate plot of the heist that they're trying to pull off, my other favorite element of a lot of heist movies is the double cross. Without spoiling anything, are there double crosses in Den of Thieves?
Well, if I answered that, I would be spoiling something.
It. Okay, off the air, you can tell me.
All I will tell you is I'm not going to say anything about that.
That's a yes, audience.
No, it's not a yes. It's not a no, because I'll just say that Den of Thieves pulls it off very well. And the director also gets the gun battles to look very realistic. They kind of bookend the movie. It starts in the very first scene while Merriman, the bad guy, and his crew hijack an armored truck outside a donut shop, and the cops come. And I mean, it's high-powered gunfire that goes on for several minutes, and there's another one of those towards the end of the movie. And they're both very well done. Unfortunately, as with Aaron Sorkin writing and directing Molly's Game, which we talked about a few weeks ago, when you have the writer also directing, you don't have anybody around to cut out the extraneous parts of the plot. And thus, Den of Thieves becomes yet another movie bloated to 2 hours and 20 minutes, just like Molly's Game.
No.
With irrelevant subplots.
That is far too long for a heist movie.
One of them involves Nick's troubles with his wife and daughters. Another one shows us 50 Cent at home scaring the crap out of the boy who's taking his daughter to the prom. Both of those subplots have nothing to do with the main storyline of the heist and should have been left out. Similarly, there are a couple of scenes where Nick, who is Gerard Butler's cop, and Merriman, the villain, they meet face-to-face for verbal showdowns that I think are supposed to remind us of Pacino and De Niro in Michael Mann's movie, The Heat.
That's why they do it.
In Den of Thieves, one of these confrontations takes place in a Japanese restaurant where Nick gives away the identity of his informant, which is a plot reveal that's even more unnecessary than the entire scene in the first place. And another thing I didn't like about this movie is that Gudegast, the director, uses some titles at the beginning of the movie with, there's just one word comes up on the screen. Flanagan, Merriman. And then he throws in the names of some Los Angeles locations that are also one-word names. And at one point, I thought, oh, they're in the town of Flanagan.
Sure.
Oh, they're in the city of Merriman.
Right.
I didn't know. Oh, those are the characters' names until well into the first third of the movie. And he does it in the same font and uses it so randomly. You don't need to do that. Just have another character use the guy's name and we'll know what his name is. You don't have to subtitle his name. It's terrible in that way. Now, I will say this. If there had been a better director and somebody who had edited the script, I think they might have been able to cut this down to a good movie. There is a good movie somewhere inside of Den of Thieves, but it is lost in this sea of bilge that has grown around it. The action sequences are good. The plot devices are terrible. I give it a 5 out of 10.
Wow. Now, if the movie doesn't do well...
I think it's going to do okay box office. It's not a huge budget movie because there are no real huge stars in it. You know, your top line money isn't going to cost you a lot here. But I don't think it's going to be a hit until it gets to Netflix or Amazon or wherever it is. This is the kind of movie people will stream at home.
If this movie doesn't do very well at the box office, it might be the only thing this guy ever directs. He'll go back to screenwriting like London Has Fallen.
Yeah.
And maybe he'll actually get better with that. Because if you say there's a good movie here, a better director could take his work and actually shape it into something great.
Yeah, I think of what the late Sidney Lumet could have done with this, or a Scorsese, or you know, I'm talking about legendary sure. directors there. But anybody who's much better with cutting things down to the core, you could have cut 30 to 40 minutes out of this movie. Make it a tight 145 mm-hmm. instead of 2 hours and 20 minutes with the nonsense filling up the plot lines that do not need to be there. So 5 out of 10 for me from Den of Thieves, 8 out of 10 from Max for 12 Strong, and lots of other showbiz stuff to get to when we come back here on the Paul Harris Show on the Big 550 KTRS. Big 550 KTRS, Max is here in the studio with me. Have you watched any more Black Mirror since I gave you the recommendation and you watched one episode and liked it?
Well, let's go back and tell the audience the full story. You gave me a recommendation about 9 months ago, and yes. then I finally watched one episode, greatly enjoyed it, and then promptly watched nothing else.
Okay. You got it. I've now watched 2 episodes of the 4th season, which came out on Netflix
a couple weeks ago. Don't like the 4th season. The Star Trek-y type episode, people don't like it.
They're wrong.
Okay.
They're absolutely wrong. And yes, it is possible to be wrong about your opinion. It's terrific.
Okay, good.
It stars Jesse Plemons,
right.
who, by the way, if you were to look back at the TV series Friday Night Lights and look at the people who starred in that, would you think that of all of the actors who were on that show, Jesse Plemons would have the best career? But he does. He's in the Spielberg movie The Post. He's in this movie Hostiles that's coming out mm-hmm. next week that that's we right. will review we'll on next Friday's show. Yeah. He's in this. He's been in a bunch of things. He's really good. Also, the second episode of the new season. And if you don't know about Black Mirror, it's an anthology series, which means it's a new story with new characters every week. There's no overlap. So you can watch them in any order. You could watch episode 4, then episode 1, then episode 5, then episode 2. It doesn't matter. The second episode of this new batch that Netflix just released was directed by Jodie Foster, who I've always known was a good director, all the way back to her days making a movie called Little Man Tate. And it stars Rosemarie DeWitt as a woman who, well, she's a little bit too careful about her daughter. You could say the kind of the ultimate helicopter parent, thanks to technology.
And
all of these things that take place in Black Mirror are kind of a near future story, and they always involve some sort of technology. And this one is very, very clever. So you may want to continue and watch those after you get through with all the other ones I've told you to watch, Max.
I'm not going to watch the 4th season because I hear it's bad.
No, it's not. Trust me. Was I right about the one I told you to watch with Bryce Dallas Howard?
It wasn't even the one you told me to watch. You told me to watch the one with the pig.
No, I said don't watch the one with the pig.
I'm just waiting for the pig to show up with Bryce Dallas Howard. Happened.
Don't watch the first episode of the first season as your first episode. You can watch it after you watched a half dozen others and you kind of get what it's about. But I think people might get turned off if they watch episode 1, season 1. Don't do that. You watched episode 1, season 3.
Yes, exactly.
And I was right about that, wasn't I?
It was very good. I greatly enjoyed it. It's called Nosedive. It's all about social media and status. And it's really not too far off from where we are right now. It's really great. And Bryce is wonderful.
Okay, this Sunday night, the SAG Awards are going to be on TNT. We're in awards season, and there's seemingly an awards show going on every weekend right mm-hmm. up until the Oscars,
yep.
which are what, beginning of March?
It's the end of February / beginning of March, whatever that weekend is, that Sunday. And also, they are announced, the nominations are announced on Tuesday.
Okay, the SAG Awards can't really have much influence on that because all the envelopes are already in for who the nominees are going to be. But the SAG Awards means that this is the people in the actors branch of the Academy are all SAG members, Screen Actors Guild.
Yeah.
And this is a pretty good indicator of who will win in the acting categories going forward, right?
If you watch if you go online and compare the SAG Award winners to past Oscar winners, they almost always line up. There are some surprises, but usually they line up, at least in the acting categories.
Now, in this Me Too movement era, the SAG Awards are doing something they've never done before, which is A, having a host, mm-hmm. and then B, making that host a woman, a very talented woman named Kristen Bell, and all of the presenters are going to be women.
It is the only award show this season. You know what? I was going to say it was the only award show with a female host because I had overheard somebody else say that, and I now realize that's not true because Olivia Munn hosted the Critics' Choice just last week.
Correct.
So, yeah.
Interestingly, in the midst of this Me Too movement, the question is, will James Franco and Aziz Ansari, who both have been sucked up into the Me Too controversy in the last 2 weeks, will they show up at the SAG Awards?
I think that there's a different answer for both of these gentlemen. I think for the same reason, one of them will show up and one of them will not. I think that James Franco will show up. He was not at Critics' Choice Awards, which happened right. I mean, he won the Golden Globe. He got up on stage. He said, thank you. Tommy Wiseau came up with him from the room. But then the sexual
allegations.
Yes, came up against him, and he was not at Critics' Choice. He won, but he was not there. Now, the thing is, SAG Awards do not split up the categories into comedy and drama like the Golden Globes. He has no chance of winning Best Actor because he's against Gary Oldman, who will win for Darkest Hour.
Yes.
So I think Franco will go because it's a night out with free cocktails and his friends. He'll get on TV when they announce him, but he won't have to be up on stage.
And he won't be a presenter because he's not female.
Now, this is the same reason, however, Aziz Ansari probably won't be there. He has a very good chance of winning for Master of None. And he already won at Golden Globes, and I'm not sure he wants to get up on stage because he's going to feel, should I address this? Should I say something? Or should I just say, thank you for the award? So I imagine he might pull a Franco, if you will, and not show up to the SAG Awards.
Now, speaking of all of this, last week we had a discussion of the controversy about Michelle Williams and Mark Wahlberg in the movie All the Money in the World, which became famous for Christopher Plummer being called in to replace Kevin Spacey in that movie. And then we found out that when they reshot those scenes, Michelle Williams was paid $1,000 and Mark Wahlberg was paid $1.5 million for the reshoots because the negotiations, which they're both represented by the same talent agency, but he apparently has better agents than she does. And there was a lot of outrage. And he has since said he's going to donate his $1.5 million to some
To Time's Up. Yeah. Time's Up is the first sort of movement that grew out of hashtag Me Too. And they have a legal defense fund for women who feel like they're being harassed. And so he is donating his $1.5 million to Time's Up. And William Morris said, you know what, we'll go ahead and kick in $500,000 of that to make it an even $2 million. And by the way, Michelle, please don't leave us, because I'm sure that's why they did that.
They did. You know what they should have done? They should have said, you know what, Michelle, we're going to give you $500,000.
Well,
because you got screwed because we didn't do our job correctly for you.
And perhaps behind the scenes, something like that happened. Her statement, I don't know if you read it.
No, I didn't hear
it. It was fantastic, and it did something unexpected. She said, you know, hey, everybody is stepping up and doing the right thing. I was happy to do this for, you know, Ridley, and I'm happy that Mark is doing this for Time's Up. But she brought it all back to Anthony Rapp, and she was like, we do this in honor of Anthony Rapp, and thank you for making your voice heard, which is an interesting thing to do, because people forget the whole reason for the reshoots is because Anthony Rapp said, hey, Kevin Spacey he came on to me when I was 14.
Touched me inappropriately.
And it was the entire thing that got Spacey removed from the project.
Right.
And she's the one saying, it's not about me, it's not about a paycheck, it's about Anthony Rapp. And I thought that was incredible.
Yeah. Interesting that it's hashtag Me Too, and she's saying, forget about Me Too,
yes.
It's him too.
Exactly.
Now, in light of all that comes the latest pay controversy, which is from the TV side, which has to do with the ABC series Black-ish, which stars Anthony Anderson and Tracy Ellis Ross, who is Diana Ross's daughter. Mm. She gets a lot less money to be on that show compared to him. And now the question is, what are they going to do about that? She has said this week in an interview, she said she may appear in fewer episodes in the next season to make up for the disparity. She'll guest on other shows to make more money and do fewer shows of Black-ish because she's not getting paid enough.
Good for her.
The network says, hey, we're just starting our negotiations with you for the next season. This is not a good time to be bringing this up. But I have to ask this, and this may seem a little bit insensitive, but I think it's a question that nobody is talking about here. When it comes to movie stars, Mark Wahlberg made $65 million last year as a movie star with his production company and his starring in movies. Michelle Williams made a lot less. Anthony Anderson has been a well-known star in Hollywood ever since he was a bit player in the first Barbershop movie with our friend Cedric the Entertainer and an Ice Cube, who I mentioned earlier in the show, because his son is in this new movie, Den of Thieves. So when you're an established actor, when you get into a new project, even if you're playing husband and wife or partners or whoever it is, don't you think the established actor is probably going to always get the higher paycheck regardless of their gender and their gender? And I would ask you this, if somebody who's relatively unknown, who's maybe made a movie or two, let's take a Jesse Plemons. If he were to co-star with Meryl Streep in a movie, do you think Jesse Plemons gets more because he's a man? No, Meryl Streep gets more because she's Meryl Streep, a much bigger star in the world. Isn't that how paychecks are divided up in many instances in show business?
Well, I think Meryl Streep is a great example, but she might be the exception to
Reese Witherspoon, you don't think gets a bigger paycheck?
Well, you know,
Nicole Kidman?
Jennifer Lawrence, when she worked
Jennifer Lawrence is another one.
But yes, but however, she was paid less than all of her American Hustle co-stars. And she'd already had the Hunger Games franchise, and she didn't realize that till after that movie. And it's because in Hollywood, it is a provable fact that women, on the whole, on the average, are just paid less for the same project. Not because of bigger stars, it's just the industry does not pay women as much. So, of course, yes, Mark Wahlberg is a bigger box office draw than Michelle Williams. I would argue in a movie like All the Money in the World, which might have a different audience going to see it, it's not really a Mark Wahlberg movie.
No, she has a bigger role and she's better in it.
Well, and she's an Academy Award nominated actress, too. So that pay disparity is certainly not not correct. Again, I've heard about actresses. I've heard about Winona Ryder being paid less than other male stars, and she was a giant icon in the 80s.
Yeah.
I'm not sure that women are always paid what they're worth.
They're absolutely not. Both in
now, Meryl Streep is probably the only actress of that caliber. You've got Meryl Streep. You've got like a Sandy Bullock. Reese Witherspoon makes a lot of money because she produces her own projects. Well,
which is why Anthony Anderson gets more money from Blackish.
Because he's a producer.
He produces the show.
But everybody that you mentioned on that list were all men. As far as, and so again, I want to see more Meryl Streeps with a Jesse Plemons by their side, and we don't have that yet.
Okay, well, the other one that came up this week was Ellen Pompeo, who's on the cover of the new issue of The Hollywood Reporter in an article in which it says that she's finally making a lot of money for Grey's Anatomy, a show she has starred on now. It's in its 14th season, and she is signed for 15 and 16. And she's now making $20 million a year minimum from that show. But when it started,
for years, she was paid less than Patrick Dempsey.
She's Meredith Grey and it's Grey's Anatomy, she's the central character. But at the time, Patrick Dempsey was a better known actor. It's like when Friends started. Courtney Cox was the highest paid part of the highest paid player of the six because she was better known.
But after they all became household names, they went in together and said, we all need to be paid the same.
Yes, I understand. But there has to be some value in I'm better known. I have made more money than you before. And even though we're co-starring in this movie now or this TV show, that's a reason why I get a higher salary at the beginning. It's not to say that it shouldn't be that way later on, where there could be more of a balance between them. But I think at the beginning, you're a bigger star. You have a better agent. You have more bargaining power. And that's why you're going to get a better paycheck. And unfortunately, for the most part, that's men.
Well, I think it's men because of the way the power structure has been set up.
Yes.
Women have not been
allowed.
I'm not
saying it's fair.
Well, I think you're questioning, will the pendulum ever swing the other way? I don't think powerful men have to worry about losing their paychecks.
No.
So I don't think that's anything that we even have to bring up. I mean, of course, yes, somebody with a better resume or a better agent is going to make a lot of money. But I think Wahlberg did the right thing in that case of saying, hey, it wasn't fair that you got paid scale. I'm going to donate the money.
I would love for there to be a day where the male co-star in a Jennifer Lawrence movie is going, hey, how come she's getting $15 million and I'm only getting two? We're not there yet. We're not there yet. Back with more showbiz stuff after Tim checks the roads on the Big 550 KTRS. It's the Friday edition of the Paul Harris Show on the Big 550 KTRS. Knuckleheads in the news and the Harris Challenge coming up in the next hour. But now Max and I are still talking about show business. If you missed it, I gave Den of Thieves, the new Gerard Butler heist movie, a 5 out of 10. And Max gave 12 Strong, the new Chris Hemsworth Americans Fighting in Afghanistan on Horseback movie, an 8 out of 10. That sounds like a ridiculous
true story, though.
Summary of it, but
happened.
It actually is what it's about. Kudos to Conan O'Brien, who, after the president's remarks of about a week and a half ago, using the S-hole word to describe countries like Haiti, Conan said, you know what? We're going to go to Haiti and show America what Haiti is really like.
Nice.
Now, he has done this before. He has gone to various places around the world. Started, I think his first one was in Finland, and he's done a bunch of other remotes. I know he did one in Israel, and he went to Cuba and did a show in Havana. This time he's going to go to Haiti. He actually is leaving today to record the show in various places. It's almost all remote pieces. It's not like he's doing it in a studio audience in front of Haitians.
It would be great if every episode was, oh, this place is horrible. He's just like, Trump was right. Oh, that'd be very funny.
I don't think that's what you're going to get, because that would be very funny if he were to do it that way. That special is going to air a week from tomorrow, Saturday, January 27th. And kudos to him for doing that. And I'm not a huge Conan O'Brien fan, but I got to say, these remote shows that he's been doing from all over the world are remarkably well produced, and he's so good at ad-libbing with the people that his producers set him up with. It makes for good television. Speaking of TV, I have a question for you, Max, a trivia question.
Oh, good.
Can you name the actress and her daughter, real-life actress and daughter, who are currently playing the same character on two different TV shows, which I don't think has ever happened before? We've had people playing the same character in the same show,
right,
where there was a flashback.
Okay.
And you saw a mother and daughter perhaps playing them that way.
Is this on cable or basic network TV?
It is on basic CBS.
Okay, so is it Big Bang Theory and Young Sheldon?
It is. Laurie Metcalf,
shot in the dark,
plays Sheldon's mother on The Big Bang Theory, and Laurie Metcalf's daughter, Zoe Perry, plays Sheldon's
mother in
the Young Sheldon show.
Very cool.
As far as I know, there's never been a time where two concurrent shows had that situation. I don't think so. I heard her talking about that on Mark Maron's podcast, WTF, which is terrific. And if you don't know, Laurie Metcalf, a proud graduate of SIUC.
And I think was the front runner to win Best Supporting Actress for her amazing work in Lady Bird. However, Allison Janney, if she wins a SAG after winning Critics' Choice and Golden Globes, it'd be three in a row.
Yeah.
And I think she'd be tough to beat for I, Tonya.
And you can't hate Allison Janney. She's terrific in the role, and she's always terrific, and Money in the Bank and everything that she does. First time I ever spotted her was in a movie called Big Night with
The chef movie, right? The cooking, right?
Yeah, Tony Shalhoub and Stanley Tucci play Italian brothers in the late 50s who have a small Italian restaurant where they make fantastic food, but it's not as good as the Italian place down the street when it comes to business, because that place gives the people what they want, whereas in this one, Tony Shalhoub, who's primo, and Stanley Tucci is secondo, the first and second sons, they make food that is so wonderfully fantastic that it's a little bit too elite. And so they, for instance, somebody comes in and orders risotto and says, doesn't this come with spaghetti? And he has to explain to her, no, it doesn't come with spaghetti because this is a starch. It's made from rice. We wouldn't give you a starch with a side of a starch. And she says, well, I want spaghetti. And Stanley Tucci goes back into the kitchen and says to Tony Shalhoub, she wants spaghetti. I won't do it. I'm not doing that. I am not serving spaghetti as a side with risotto. And Allison Janney is in there as kind of a gangly, awkward young woman who is a friend of Tony Shalhoub's, who's invited to this big dinner that they decide to have, because they're told that Louis Prima is going to come to their restaurant. Louis Prima was a huge star of that era. He's going to be in town. He's going to come to their restaurant for a big dinner. So they plan this huge meal. And the movie is really about the expectation, the presentation, and the work that they do in the kitchen and throughout the restaurant in preparation for the big night. If you haven't seen it, that's one you may want to get on DVD or put in your queue. I don't know if it's streaming anywhere because it's quite old. At least 25, maybe 30 years old, but it's really good. And that was the first time I ever saw Allison Janney. Speaking of TV, after the success of Will and Grace coming back on NBC, they're now talking about bringing back another sitcom from even before that era, Mad About You, with Paul Reiser and Helen Hunt.
I never liked that show.
I liked the show in the first year or two because I was a big Paul Reiser fan. I'd seen him in Diner. I'd seen him doing stand-up, both on TV and in person.
See, this is where you and I differ.
Helen Hunt was very, very likable, and the chemistry that they had there seemed to work for me, not for you, obviously. I think maybe you caught up with it in the later seasons.
I suppose so. Yeah, I don't like Paul Reiser, so there's a strike against.
That's going to hurt when the show stars Paul Reiser.
Sure, sure.
NBC is talking to them in informal talks. The trades say.
That's just when NBC stops by your house. Hey, what's going on?
Yeah.
You like doing a show?
The show ran for seven seasons, 1992 to 1999, and now they're talking about coming back for a limited run, which would follow the Paul Reiser and Helen Hunt characters, who in the initial series were newlyweds, and they were dealing with what it's like to live with somebody and love somebody at the beginning of your marriage. This one would be grappling with empty nest syndrome in the wake of their now 17-year-old daughter Mabel's admission to college.
Oh, I'd be hoping they'd get divorced or something. It'd be all about a divorce, like no longer mad about you or possibly mad at you.
No, I don't think so. Paul Reiser told People magazine that he's open to the idea of bringing the show back in some form. We'll see if that actually happens.
What else does he have going on?
He's actually in Stranger Things. He's in Red Oaks.
That's right. He was in season two of Stranger Things.
Stranger Things is on Netflix. He's in Red Oaks, which is a continuing series on Amazon. And I think he's got a new show. He's got a new show on Hulu about backstage at The Tonight Show with Johnny Carson.
Yeah, I didn't like him in Stranger Things either.
You don't like him at all. Well, now there are three streaming services in which you can skip Paul Reiser shows. Now, you had something about Stranger Things you wanted to mention.
I do. Speaking of Stranger Things, of course, that cast is moving on to their newest projects. You've got David Harbour, who's going to be the new Hellboy in an upcoming movie. And the young woman who plays the character Eleven is named Millie Bobby Brown. She is a British actress. And she just signed what could be her next big franchise. This could be her motion picture Harry Potter-esque franchise. It's based on a series of books that came out, I think, around 2006, 2007, and they're based on Sherlock Holmes's younger sister. Now, Sherlock Holmes doesn't have a younger sister in the official canon. He, of course, has an older brother, Mycroft, who's actually smarter than Sherlock. But in this version of the story, he has a younger, she's 20 years his senior. It opens up when she's 14, and he's gone missing, and she has to figure out why. And it's called
If she's 20 years his senior and she's 14, he's not born yet.
No. He is 20 years her senior.
Oh, her? Okay.
Yes.
All right.
So he would be 34.
I gotcha.
In this, and she would be 14.
And he's gone missing, and she has to be the teenage detective.
Exactly.
The Nancy Drew, if you will.
Well, it's funny you bring up Nancy Drew, because years and years ago, I want to say around 2006 or 2007, right when these books were being written or published, you had a big screen Nancy Drew, the first one in a very long time, since the black and white days, I believe, and it starred Emma Roberts. And it had a pretty decent director. I am blanking on his name right now. It was a pretty good movie for younger kids. Pretty decent supporting cast. You had some cameos like Bruce Willis was in there, and I thought Emma Roberts was really good as Nancy Drew, but nobody cared. Nobody cared at all, and that was going to be the next big detective franchise for kids, and it stalled. This is the first time this has happened since then. It's going to be called The Enola Holmes Mysteries, E-N-O-L-A. So just like Mycroft and Sherlock, she has a strange name.
Okay.
But I think this could be huge if it's a good enough script.
And is that a big screen? It sounds like it would be better as a streaming series.
Yeah, well, they want to bring it to the big screen. I think she wants to break into motion pictures. So, or her agents want her to.
Hopefully they're better than Michelle Williams' agents.
Yes, exactly.
All right, that's the showbiz stuff for this week. Next week we will review Christian Bale in a... can you call it a Western? I guess you can. It's called Hostiles. We'll tell you about that next week. And also Annette Bening in a new movie, an indie called Film Stars Don't Die in Liverpool. That's next week here on the Showbiz Show. Next hour, the Harris Challenge and Knuckleheads in the News as we continue on the Paul Harris Show on the Big 550 KTRS.